and welcome to the Not Alone podcast. I'm Samuel Fredrickson.
And I'm Jason Moitoso.
First things first, Black Lives Matter. If you disagree, just stop listening now. Second things, what we want to talk about to you today, is that we're just done with Aleister Crowley. I'm just done with him. Yeah, you're right, for now.
Sam, wait. I need to know the answers to all my questions.
Meaning
to the universe.
Your questions will be answered.
How to summon a demon.
That will all come in September.
WikiHow didn't help.
Oh no. You just couldn't get it, couldn't piece together those cryptic pictures.
Apparently not.
So we decided to go ahead and postpone concluding our Crowley series simply because I was really tired of it, and I like would sit at my computer all day and like bang my head on things and be like, care, damn you, care. And I just couldn't. So I decided I'd ask the people what they think, and the overwhelming majority of people were like, yeah, we need a little bit of a break from that one. And so we've decided we're going to go ahead and finish that up in the fall. Jason, you got anything you want to say about that?
No, I completely agree. It became mind-numbing, to say the least.
Yeah.
And this is probably the best case scenario for everyone.
Good. So instead, everyone's decided. Initially, I was going to be like, let's do some happy things after the Crowley, and we may still do that in the fall.
Yeah, not now.
No, not
clear
now.
To me.
What we're going to be covering for the next 3 months, ideally, are just going to be some of the craziest things you've ever heard, like the good old Not Alone, alien abductions, crazy hauntings. I've got at least one conspiracy, if not a couple, that I want us to take a look at, especially as the world burns down around us. I think it's important to be aware of what the global elite is trying to do. But that's not true. But we'll talk about that another
time.
What part
isn't true, Sam? I don't believe you. I'm so
confused. We'll talk about all that another time, another episode. Probably the episode right after this. These 2 to 3 episodes? I think
two
one
to
of
three.
The, what?
What do you mean?
Here's the problem. Here's my problem. I think that I need to do a better job of saying how many episodes something is going to be and not just leave it open-ended like that. So I'm going to tell you, it's 2. It's 2. And I don't care how long the second one is. It's 2. I'm not spending more
than that.
Remember
when you're like, Crowley will only be like 4.
Yeah, 4 episodes.
That's all it'll ever be.
Stupid. Absolutely stupid. Inane. So this one will be a 2-parter. It's pretty good. This one was suggested to us by our good friend Luke. He said, hey, I want some of that good alien crazy. Have you ever heard about this thing that we're going to talk about? And I initially had said, yeah, I had heard about that. It sounds like a bunch of crap, in my opinion. And furthermore, I didn't know how much there would be to this subject. And as I started digging in, I realized that this subject is basically the genesis for a huge amount of UFO culture to this day. And a lot of ideas that have pervaded the UFO camps in the last few decades come from this exact place. So
it's also some like the weirdest parts of the UFO phenomenon,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, in general, like, it's just
exactly
strange.
It's just bizarre. No matter what it is, it's bizarre. And so we are going to be talking about, this week and next week, about Dulce Base, the secret underground facility where mankind and extraterrestrial work together for some nefarious purpose that we're not, well, we are or are not sure of, depending on where you're coming from here.
It's not the betterment of the species, no?
It's absolutely not that. It is undeniably not the betterment of humanity. That's for sure. Jason,
selfish.
Had you heard of Dulce before this?
No. Honestly, when I was reading it, I read it as Dulce.
No, I know. Most people do. Myself included. I'm glad I actually watched.
Okay.
This was one of the few that I was like, okay, you know what? There's a lot here. I'm actually going to listen to other podcasts and like watch some documentaries. Usually I just do all of my stuff through reading. But I said, no, I'm going to listen and watch this. And I'm glad I did. Otherwise I'd be saying Dolce and people would be very, very upset with me, I'm sure.
But no, I mean, I haven't really heard anything like this. It makes mostly zero sense.
All right. All right. Good. Mostly zero. See, and that's the thing is to me. Well, all right. We'll talk about it.
Well, without giving away exactly what we're talking about for those that don't know, it definitely like helps establish a pop culture icon as far as
sure.
UFO abductions
yeah.
go.
Absolutely.
As far as it makes
exactly.
me concerned.
That was one of the things that surprised me. I was like, oh, this is where that comes from. And we'll just go ahead and get into it now. And we'll talk about what we think about it after.
So we don't have to talk so cryptically.
Cryptic and ambiguous. All right. So
we're talking about the Chupacabra.
We're talking about that goat sucker down south, the Chupa. No. We are talking about, though, some UFOs, if you hadn't gathered that somehow. We're
Dang.
Also talking about one of the most interesting, to me, aspects of the UFO phenomena, which is cattle mutilation, which we've talked about before. I think it was just on our Skinwalker Ranch episodes. I think that's the only time we talked about it before. But it factors really heavily into this. Let's start. All right, we're going to start by talking about Dulce, New Mexico proper. What is Dulce? What does that mean? Well, Dulce is an area. It's a small community of just under 3,000 people. When I looked online, it did not say that it was a town. It said it was a census designated place. Which
so
less than a town,
less than
I think,
a town.
Is what we're supposed to take from that. And it could also be that the reason why Dulce, almost the entirety of Dulce's population, they are members of the Jicarilla Apache tribe, for whom the land functions as a part of a reservation. So Dulce was founded back in 1887 as a ranching operation, which was headed by the Gomez family. And over the following 133 years, it has stayed pretty small. It's even reported that the town itself doesn't have a single traffic light. Regardless of any of that, though, it has become a hotspot, a place of intense paranormal activity. Now, although it is a relatively quiet area, the first big reports of high strangeness started popping up back in the 1970s. To be specific, it was sometime between 1975 and 1976 when Gabe Valdez, a New Mexico State Police officer, began investigating a slew of strange cattle mutilations, which was disturbing, but was also frequently companioned by UFO activity. Now, the bodies were strange, even stranger than your typical cattle mutilations, which are usually pretty weird affairs. And like I said at the beginning of this episode, we've talked about cattle mutilations before. Jason, you don't believe in them, which is probably a shock to no one at all.
I mean, I don't believe that they're done by UFOs or extraterrestrials.
You believe that they're simply, what, scavengers?
Not necessarily, but I mean, it can be to some degree to some of the mutilation, but I mean...
That is true.
People are cruel as well, which is blatantly obvious. So, I mean, that kind of thing could probably happen. It could even be,
Whoa.
I don't know, a rival ranch maybe, trying to cause some sort of chaos or panic.
Okay, okay.
Maybe out a large corporate buyout scheme. I don't know.
It's definitely not a UFO, though.
I just don't see the point.
Yeah. Well, you wouldn't, because you don't believe in UFOs. So I would say that the point is to be able to run scientific tests on animals to see how they're developing or see like what their levels are of different things and vitamins and minerals or whatever.
I mean, in that case, why not just abduct one, like a calf, and raise it to full health?
Well, because then whatever you're feeding it or whatever you're doing to raise it is going to influence its genetic and its biological makeup, not its genetic makeup, but its chemical makeup. Whereas if you're going to an already grown cow and you pick it up and you cut out its butt and you cut off its sex organs and you take off its lower lip, what else did they do? Some other stuff. And then you put it back on the ground and you keep those things and you analyze that, then you're getting it from its own proper actual environment without cross-contaminating it with your alien junk.
Okay, why do you have to do that dozens of times?
Because every cow is different and they're all beautiful creations.
I mean, yes, but to some degree, it's not necessary. If you're doing it on that educational level, that research purpose, there's not that big of a point to do just strictly that kind of weird autopsy or experimentation. Like, we will go over some other organs that seem to be affected by something or in some way, but those are soft tissues. You're not really looking, like, I'm shocked that we haven't seen anything where, like, the four guts that are in a cow are gone or have been messed with in some degree, because that is an anatomical feature that is more interesting than ours, because we do not have that many chambers of our stomach.
All right. I see what you're saying. But yeah, so that's like your typical, is that usually they take, again, like Jason says, the soft tissues, which makes it very easy to say, okay, this could also be like a predator, who's doing things as well. Your soft tissues, your
also the first things to decay.
Yeah. So the tongue, the lower lip, the sex organs, and the rectum are usually what's removed in a standard cattle mutilation case. So these cases that Gabe was catching on to were even a little bit beyond that. They went a little bit further. For instance, in most of the cases, many of them, the cow would be drained of blood. There would be no blood either on the ground or coming out of the cow or in the cow once they opened it to see what was going on. There were also very strange markings on the legs, and the legs themselves, more often than not, were broken or they were pulled out of their socket, pulled out of their joint. In addition to this, Valdez found a number of strange tracks, pretty much accompanying every body, usually a little bit away. And essentially what they were 28-inch diameter circles. There were three of them, and then they would be 28 inches in diameter, and they'd be about 4 inches apart from each other. So very unique, very big. I mean, that's 3 2-foot wide circles. Interesting tracks. He also found, or claims that he found, some other paraphernalia. He found things like gas masks. He found things like syringes and bits of paper as well. So whatever was happening here, Valdez was pretty sure was not just a natural scavenger. And of course, when you're dealing with a large amount of mutilations, as the world, especially as the United States saw between the end of the 1960s and up through the 1970s, you're dealing with a large amount. I mean, I'm talking like thousands of cattle being mutilated. Of course, a good amount of them are probably going to be scavengers, but there are always some that are outliers that don't really make a lot of sense in that area. What Valdez was able to put together, or at least what his working theory was that these cows had been dropped out of the sky. And again, that comes from seeing their joints being, or their legs being pulled out of their sockets. They found bruising and contusions that seemed to be consistent with the cow's legs being tied at a certain point as if they were tied, kind of dangled out of the plane, the UFO, the whatever, and then untied or whatever from there as well. Jason, what do you think about that? Is there any other reason you can think of for like strange contusions or legs being pulled out of sockets other than they fell out of the sky? I'm guessing there is.
I mean, no, I think that's probably pretty accurate. Oh, nice. To some degree. Well, I mean, when you think about it, like the only reason why those kind of injuries would happen is from a pull of some magnitude. Mm-hmm. So stringing them up and flying them over is one way to doing it. So one thing that I didn't see through the show notes, and I didn't see also doing some of my own behind the scenes research as well. Do we know if these cattle were dropped on the same property or if they were found elsewhere?
As far as I know, so the main person that this is happening to almost consistently, at least that's working with Valdez, is actually a rancher from that Gomez family who founded the settlement. Mm-hmm. It was a great-great-grandson. And as far as I can tell, they all came out of his property and were found on his property. I think usually pretty close to where they theoretically were taken, but at the very least, they were all found on his area and their proper area.
Interesting. Okay. I'm assuming because they originally established it, their area is probably also quite large.
Oh, yeah.
But I would, from the lack of physical on-scene evidence as far as like scuffles or tracks or stuff like that, the lack of blood, the lack of dry blood or staining of it is definitely coinciding with his idea that they were probably moved there mm-hmm. sometime after time of death. But by what?
Yeah.
Don't know.
Yeah.
How? I would probably assume maybe like a helicopter.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because otherwise, if it was like a plane or something that had more trajectory to it, you would probably see some sort of almost like a comet hitting or a meteor hitting the ground where you have like an actual trail. Yeah. Of like a skid mark. Something like a helicopter would probably be the only thing that makes real sense as far as dropping it back down.
Yeah, yeah. So basically you're saying if it's in a plane and you push it out, like the cow is still going to have like a forward momentum as it
falls. It's got momentum, yeah.
Whereas here you Correct. Can just drop it down flat. That makes sense.
Yeah.
So.
And you can also get a lot lower.
Yeah, without attracting too much attention, which is something that we'll talk about attracting that attention.
Right. And this is also a very rural community too. So the likelihood of eyes seeing you if you don't want to be seen is probably pretty mm-hmm. low.
So over the next couple of years, the cattle mutilations in Dulce, they rose to 90 head of cattle that were mutilated within 3 years. One very interesting case that took place actually happened not with the Gomez family, but actually with the chief of the Jicarilla Apache tribe. So he calls Valdez late one night. He says, "Hey, I've got three of my cattle that have been, you know, mutilated. I need you to get out here right away." And Valdez says, it's late. I'll get there in the morning. He says, "No, you need to come right away." Well, why? Well, as we've mentioned, in addition to the cattle mutilations, at the same time, there were reports of strange lights. Now, the lights were usually orange in color. They were typically silent, although there were a few accounts of them sounding kind of like, the witnesses said, like a lawnmower in the air was what they would describe the engine sounding like.
Interesting. And you know what a lawnmower has?
Blades. Oh, yeah.
You know what a helicopter has?
Blades. So, boom. We've done it. Cracked
this one wide open. But who did it?
Essentially, Valdez is told by the chief, "You need to come right now because the lights are still here. There are still lights in my field that I think are what's responsible for this." So he jumps in the car and goes. Typically, you know, you see the light maybe the night before, you go out the next day, cattle's mutilated. They'd been able to essentially catch it in the act. So Valdez goes. He takes backup with him, as well as I think he's got the chief and some of his people with him as well. And they're driving through the chief's field towards this big orange light that's ahead of them. They get pretty close to it. They're not hearing any sound, as far as they can tell. And suddenly the orange light turns off and it disappears. And they look up. They don't see anything there. Suddenly they see another light a couple miles away from them. Same thing. Orange light. They flip a Yui. They start going towards it. It's there for a couple minutes, just long enough for them to approach. And then suddenly it does the same thing. It disappears, reappears a few miles away from them as well. And so they're basically chasing this thing all over the town.
That sounds like a potentially like a really weird
it
mirage.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because you're actively chasing it, but you can't ever catch it. It's like trying to catch the rainbow.
Exactly. And so it does. Every time that they get close to it, it just disappears. And then they go back and they finally give up on it. They go back and they find that these three cattle are mutilated in the exact consistent fashion that the rest of the cattle had been mutilated. And so it was part of that larger phenomena. Those sorts of stories are all around Dulce at the time that this is happening. It's interesting because you have said twice now, and I don't even think I put it in the notes. In fact, I'm pretty sure I didn't. You've said twice now that if this was going to be done by theoretically something above, human at least, it would probably be a helicopter. Of course, the biggest thing about that is that helicopters are quite loud. You know, you can't, it's quite hard to get a helicopter over an area without causing quite a loud noise. Throughout the history of paranormal investigation, there has been this idea of a silent helicopter, something that the government or whatever, probably the government, has come up with that is able to move around very much the same way that a silenced gun is portrayed in like films. It's not actually 100% silenced, but it's a heck of a lot better than it just being out and about. And what's in?
Well, I mean, silencers are actually not incredibly helpful, not to the extent that they are shown in movies and TV shows. I think it was SEAL Team 6 used a stealth helicopter when they took out Bin Laden. But I still think that, I think to public knowledge, at least it's quieter, but it's not dead silent of a helicopter to travel in. But that was 2010? Yeah.
2011.
Somewhere around there?
They took him out.
2011?
Yeah. And so that's the thing, is that this is one of those cases where the idea of this thing has been around since like the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, but it's not until 2011 that it actually makes like an appearance in the mainstream. But there's actually been like recently, I don't know how recently, but declassified documents that show modified versions of a Hughes 500 helicopter, known as a Loach to aviators in Vietnam, that was used during Vietnam. It wasn't used a lot. I think it was literally only used twice. But during Vietnam, they had a modified Hughes 500 helicopter. They called it a 500P that was black, totally black, so you wouldn't have seen it in the dead of night.
Yeah.
That made basically about as much sound as a lawnmower might make. But it's making that sound way up high in the air, and so it's easier to get in and out of different areas. So it's one of those times where, okay, we've got these ideas coming out of Dulce that there are these silent black helicopters in the 1970s. And while it's impossible to prove that that's what they saw or what was going on, that's a pretty good contender for what might be happening here. So
at least not without government support.
Exactly. It's not a one-off sort of thing, just some rando.
Hypothetically, it could be something. So, which I know, like modern stealth vehicles care more about radar detection, systems and fooling that
rather than sound
than what they do on sound alone. Yeah,
exactly. So that is one example. The next really big thing that happened on the Dulce cattle mutilation front happened in 1978. It was one of the higher profile cases, which involved an 11-month-old bull belonging to the Gomez cattle or Gomez ranching family. The fish and game officer that had seen a large orange light in the sky flying along a ridge south of the meadow where the bull was discovered. And so the liver, as well as bits of the heart, were sent to Los Alamos Scientific Laboratories. They found that the liver contained no copper, which a normal healthy liver has small amounts of copper. It was flooded with calcium, magnesium, and phosphorus, as well as having higher levels of zinc and potassium. Now, the blood samples that were taken were discolored. They appeared as a very light pink, and they did not clot for days after. And the flesh of the animal was also found to be discolored, even brittle. When it comes to the skin of the animal, it was described as brittle. These anomalies could not be explained by the researchers at Los Alamos, according to an official declassified FBI report talking about this phenomena.
So something happened to this animal at a cellular level.
Yes.
It's not this is not just simply cutting open and seeing what's inside.
Exactly. But that same report gives us an idea of something even weirder that occurs. So this report is written by a man named Kenneth M. Rommel. He had been a special agent with the Bureau for 26 years when he began investigating the cattle mutilations. According to him, a local cop, who is almost certainly Valdez, and a retired scientist, after this, they decided to do a test on a large herd of 120 cattle. What they did is they took them and they forced them all through a black light illuminated chute. As they went through, out of this 125, they found five animals that had been marked with a glittery substance on the right side of the neck, the right ear, and the right leg. So the idea was that these animals were marked previously somehow. They were either watched for a long period of time, or they were marked almost immediately prior to taking, maybe a few days or a week before being taken. And then in the night, when whatever it was came to grab them, they were just able to identify them at that point.
With the UV light.
Yes, yes.
Okay, so did they share anything else in similarity? Were they like the young bull? Were they also younger animals, or did they range? Were they all...
They were definitely...
male? Do we have anything like that?
I can't remember the sex breakdown. They were definitely all younger. They were all, okay. I think, less than 3 years old, at the very least. So it wasn't just a huge scattering. They were definitely interested in a specific set that met certain conditions. And again, other than the age, I can't remember what the other ones were. I unfortunately didn't write them down. But after this, Gomez sells not only those five, but anything close to it, anything of the same age range. If there was a sex breakdown, he just sold all of those out and said, you know, goodbye. I'm not going to deal with this again from there.
So we weren't able to even keep track of those animals.
Right. We don't know what happened to them, if they were taken from somewhere else, or what would have happened if they did.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, the other thing...
How did we stumble upon the use of UV? That seems rather...
Well, there was just a sign...
Specific.
So they... I guess what they said is that because... I think the logical way that this went is that because that bull had such significantly different everything, you know, its liver, its blood, its skin, because of that, they figured that there had to be some sort of way that the cattle mutilators were able to identify it in the dead of night without raising too much alarm to make sure that they get the right one. Because other samples taken from cows in the same herd, taken randomly, did not have, again, the super light pink blood that wouldn't clot or any of that. What's interesting is that after this, one thing that they were able to confirm is that, like I said, with that bull, its skin was brittle. And in these marked cows, their skin was tested and they did find significantly higher concentrations of potassium and magnesium in the skin of the marked cows than the unmarked cows. So it, again, they were just like, well, there's got to be some way that they knew to take this specific dude in the middle of the night. What's it going to be?
Right, which infrared wouldn't make sense because that would just highlight all the cattle.
There you go.
So the next obvious answer then would probably be ultraviolet.
There you go.
Which I have no idea how that would react or interact or how you even, I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's pretty much the anthem of Dulce is, I don't know. Okay. Especially as we get into the wilder things. But Valdez came across another troubling piece of information, which is that a couple of days before their experiment, there had been a craft that was seen in the town of Taos. I think it's Taos. It may be Taos. About 90 miles away from Dulce as the crow flies. Now, Taos has had its own share of cattle mutilations, as well as its own distinct paranormal phenomena, which is known as the Taos hum, which is essentially a nonstop humming noise that some residents of Taos, the estimates are maybe as low as only 2% of people in Taos, but some residents hear it day and night without any sort of apparent cause. So there's just kind of a weird side.
Stuff going on in the desert kind of thing.
It's a weird desert. But on the 1st of July, 1978, three different families in Taos reported seeing a bright orange light, which was hovering over a truck just after midnight. The following morning, one of the witnesses went to check on the truck, and they found a thin white powder on the roof of the cab. The powder was recovered by Valdez and sent away for testing. It contained, as you may guess,
potassium
and magnesium.
And zinc.
Yep.
I was only very slightly right.
Very slightly off. So around this time, we've got orange lights in the sky. They're hovering. They're coming up, they're going down, they're disappearing. They're turning off, they're turning on. We've got magnesium, we've got zinc, we've got cattle mutilations. And we've got Gabe Valdez, who's in the middle of it all, saying, what the hickety heck is going on here? But the next thing that happens is that Gomez, the rancher, claims that he starts to get threatening calls, basically saying, stop caring. Stop caring about your cattle. It's fine. Don't pursue this line of questioning. Don't try to figure out what's going on here, or something worse is going to happen to you from there. So we start to, again, get this idea of really a high-level, organized situation.
Operation, yeah.
Yeah. But, oh, go ahead.
We don't know when they get tagged.
No, we don't know when they get tagged.
So are they getting tagged at night, or is there someone on the ground?
That's the question. It would seem, again...
Is it some sort of inspector, you know?
Right. Somebody who's coming around. It's like their job. It would seem as though...
Because it has to be an injectable, clearly. Like...
Here's the thing. Valdez comes away with this with a very good idea of what's going on, one that I think he's right about, and we'll actually talk about that near the end of the episode. So maybe we'll revisit this then, because I think it makes a bit more sense when you put all the different pieces of what's going on together. I think it's important for us to zoom out and realize that these cattle mutilations were by no means only happening in Dulce or even New Mexico at the time, or even the greater southwestern United States at the time. The Midwest, the Southwest, the Pacific Northwest, they all experienced huge amounts, thousands of cases of cattle mutilations in the 1970s. So much so that as the decade was drawing to a close, a senator from New Mexico, a man named Harrison Schmitt, who apparently was an astronaut who walked on the moon, just as a little,
that's pretty
cool. Just a little aside there. He calls a meeting of ranchers and law enforcement from all around, New Mexico, Colorado, Montana, Arkansas, Nebraska. They all come together and meet at the Albuquerque Public Library in order to collaborate vis-a-vis what the heck is going on with these cattle mutilations. Now, of course, as you might expect, Gabe Valdez attended, but among those in attendance was another man, a man who had already written the senator a number of letters, not necessarily regarding the cattle mutilation itself, although he was definitely interested in that, but regarding something higher, something bigger than all of this. That man's name is Paul Benowitz, and he is one of the most fascinating and tragic individuals of the UFO community, the UFO mythology and history, really, of the 1970s and beyond until up to the present day. Like I said, what Benowitz does is that he establishes these elements of the UFO myth and legends that are still in circulation, going strong to this day. So, Benowitz.
Okay, who is this guy?
Benowitz.
Why?
What?
I was going to say, why does he matter? Oh, you're about to tell me.
Okay, all right. Benowitz, I'm glad you asked. He is a businessman. He is a engineer and a physicist who lives in Albuquerque, New Mexico, the time that all of this is happening. He has a little, well, I don't know how big it was. I'd say probably a modest operation, building different components, things like temperature gauges and compasses, at his own company that he's founded called Thunder Scientific. These gauges and components were then sent to the Air Force. They were sold to NASA, all over the place. And
okay, so he's operating in the private sector, but he has government contracts.
Exactly.
Okay.
And both his official business, his official company, Thunder Scientific, as well as his private residency, are both essentially across the street from Kirtland Air Force Base, which is situated in southeast Albuquerque. Literally, the perimeter fence of the base is across the street from Thunder Scientific.
Well.
Also nearby, about 3.5 miles away from Kirtland, was Manzano Mountain, which was home to another airbase. And it has been declassified since, although it sounds as though it was not public knowledge, but not necessarily uncommon knowledge, that Manzano Mountain was also the home to the largest stockpile of nuclear weapons in the continental United States at the time. So there was that, just 5 miles outside of a major populated area. Kind of spooky, if you think about it. It will also house an emergency presidential relocation center should something happen, and of course was therefore completely and totally equipped and ready to be able to fire these missiles at any given moment should the need arise. So, and then 5 miles away, you have Paul Benowitz. Now, in the late summer of 1979, between the end of August and the beginning of September, Benowitz begins to notice something very, very strange happening on the Air Force Base as well as over and around the Manzano Mountains. He sees lights that would take off silently from the ground about half a mile from his home. So now I live a long ways away from the airport. I used to live about a mile away from the airport, just like Jason. And if things are flying in and out of that airport, you hear it. You hear it all hours of the day. We also lived near a base, Air Force base, sorry, where they would fly, what are they, F-16s?
I'm not sure.
They'd fly these big old planes out of, and again, you'd hear that day and night. And yet, as Benowitz is seeing these lights just turn on and quickly rise up into the air, he's not hearing a single thing. Now, these lights, which were also witnessed by his wife, they would change color or they'd be multicolored. They would lift off and then they would go over to the mountain and they would fly loops around the mountain, doing all that good UFO stuff, turning at impossible speeds, coming to a complete stop and accelerating on the turn of a dime. Just all that good non-ballistic motion sort of stuff that we've been conditioned to associate with UFOs at this point. Sometimes they went so fast that he couldn't even follow them. They would essentially, and not just could he not follow them, they appeared to wink out of existence and then come back into existence as if teleporting or something like that. Or maybe just going very, very quickly, appearing miles away from where they were last seen. Now, like I said, Benowitz is a scientist. So he begins documenting everything just like a good scientist should. He's shooting photo and video footage. He's decided he builds his own antennas to start listening for audio transmissions using his scientific equipment. And in his mind, he hits a very terrifying but still very real jackpot. Over the months, Benowitz accumulates a mass of video, audio, and photographic evidence. Now, he holds on to this and essentially keeps it to himself for a time, about a year. Finally, in October of 1980, on October 24th of 1980, Benowitz has, in his mind, figured out what is going on here. And because he's a good American patriot, he decides that it's his duty to make sure that the government knows what's going on here. So he, yep. So this is a cautionary tale, kids. Whatever you think you know, don't tell the government. Don't do it. They're not going to try to help you. Don't do it. Benowitz starts by talking, it seems, at least one of the books that I read. So I'm consulting a number of works on this, published books. One is Mirage Men. The other one is Project Beta. Both are great, great books for this. And it makes it sound like he starts by talking with maybe people that he just knows by virtue of being a government contractor. Just your average people on the base saying, hey, there's something going on, you know, someone needs to listen to me. And everyone says, oh, Paul, you're such a good guy, but yeah, I think everything's fine. Don't worry about it. And so he finally decides to leapfrog over everybody's head, and he places a call to the base security commander, a man by the name of Colonel Ernest Edwards. Like I said, this call takes place on October 24th, 1980, so about 13 to 14 months after he's begun witnessing all of this.
Gotcha. And at this point in time, he probably has quite a bit amount of data.
He has hundreds of feet of video.
Hundreds of foot.
He's like a hydra, but with feet. He's
like a centipede.
Yeah. A millipede. He's got hundreds of feet of video evidence. He's got thousands of photographs, and he's got...
Boy, you can't say that very much anymore.
No.
He has hundreds of feet of video evidence. What are you talking
right?
about?
Film.
What's that?
Film, my good man. He's got audio transcriptions, audio recordings. So he starts talking to Edwards. He explains that the base has a serious security problem. Now, this, because he was the base security commander, probably was worth Edwards' time. It captured his interest, I would say. But as the calls went on, he realized that something wasn't right about Benowitz. See, Benowitz was convinced that what he was seeing were, of course, UFOs. They were alien craft that were engaged in some sort of intimidation, some sort of ruffling their feathers, basically, or even possibly could be laying the way, and we'll see this developed a little bit further, laying the way for a potential invasion, an overtaking of the base itself.
How could they?
Now, what Edwards does is very significant. He does not say, you're crazy. He does not say, thank you, we'll look into it, and then never call him back. Edwards says, it sounds like we have a real problem here. He takes and he transfers Paul Benowitz over to a man who is the most, probably the most hated man in all of ufology, a real enigma of a dude, just a monster on one hand and a patriot or whatever on the other. And this man is named Richard Doty. At this point, I believe I heard someone say, I think Doty was a sergeant at the time that this happened. Now, Doty is a member of the Air Force Office of Special Investigations. He's a special agent for that office.
Cool.
Yes. Now, apparently, his kind of day-to-day life, at least according to Edwards, was kind of just busting drugs on the base and around the areas and just making sure everything was tip-top up to shape. He had come to the base about, well, he got there in June. So it was only 5 months or so that he was there. But Edwards says, okay, you need to talk to Doty. So Doty is apparently very fascinated by what Paul Benowitz has to say. He recommends to Benowitz that they meet in person and they talk about, you know, what Paul has found and what's going on and the alien threat and everything. Now, the two initially meet up at Benowitz's work, at which point Doty finds himself shocked by just how much information Paul Benowitz has on what Doty claims is classified advanced flight projects. Doty is, or claims to be, and we have absolutely no reason to believe he's lying. This is all extremely well documented, or extremely well documented. At least this is. I mean, he's always lying all the time, okay, because Doty is a government disinformation agent. It is his job to protect government secrets any way that's possible. Now, what's interesting is that I went onto the FBI's records and I looked for any records that I could find about Kirtland Air Force Base. The only record I could find about Kirtland Air Force Base, granted it was before this time, but it was a record detailing counterintelligence projects that had been run out of Kirtland Air Force Base. So we know, without a doubt, that this sort of information campaigning happened in Albuquerque out of Kirtland Air Force Base at this
time. That's so strange.
It's extremely strange.
In basically nowhere in New Mexico, they're running disinformation.
Yep.
You'd think it'd be, you know, I don't know, downtown New York or something.
And I'm sure.
Like somewhere where like information gets passed frequently.
Yeah. I'm sure they are there as well. But it was just bizarre to me that was the only thing I could find about Kirtland in the FBI records. So,
which would actually give him a real reason for being on the base.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
Because as like up until you just said that, I'm like, why is he there then?
Yeah. And again, the idea is that he comes in to be the drug guy. Nobody knows what that means. That's just what Edward says. But it definitely seems like that's just a cover. Or even if that's part of his job, it's not the real of it. So
right.
He is flabbergasted by what Paul has been able to pick up. He returns to his superiors that day, and he tells them that Paul Benowitz is privy to information that he absolutely should not be privy to. This was met with a request by the National Security Agency to meet Benowitz at his home. So again, what the frick? What the heck? You have this guy. He's just this dude who really likes aliens. And it's documented, obviously, that Benowitz is very interested in UFOs and aliens before any of this happens. We'll get into that in a moment. But it's just amazing to me that within 2 days of that initial call, he has a meeting with Benowitz, Doty does, and he is directed by the NSA then to meet with him again on the 26th. So within 2 days, the NSA has their hands in this. The Air Force Office of Special Investigation has their hands in it. It's a...
Wait, NSA?
The NSA. The National Security Agency.
Yeah.
Are sending Doty to Benowitz's home. And there's a memo. Wild. There's a declassified memo that proves this. That's what's so crazy about this, is I like started reading all of this and I was like, yeah, sure. The guy's probably just a nerd. He's probably just a big old geek who likes to pretend that he was in the military. And if we look, there's probably no evidence. All of this is extremely well documented, terrifyingly so. So essentially, the reason that we know who Rick Doty is beyond this, as this disinformation agent, doesn't come from Paul Benowitz. Unfortunately, Paul Benowitz, as we'll talk about, never believes that Doty is a disinformation agent, even when Doty tells him years down the line. Where we get this information is from another ufologist, another researcher named Linda Moulton Howe. And Howe is a journalist whose fame in the UFO circles comes mainly from her work researching the cattle mutilation phenomena. She produced a documentary called A Strange Harvest that really brought it, or at least brought the idea of cattle mutilation as a UFO event into the mainstream consciousness. Now,
solid name too.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Whoever figured that name out. Brilliant.
That's a beautiful name. Now, she met with Doty sometime after her documentary aired. She was getting ready to produce another documentary, basically. And she met with him. I believe it was actually at Kirtland Air Force Base, but don't quote me on that. She meets with him, and he starts by taking her to a room that he says is the commander's office. It's not the commander's office, but he says it is. He closes the door, and the first thing he says is, that documentary of yours really got people scared. And by people, Howe knows that he's talking about the government and the higher-ups. And she says, why would that be? And he says, no one would believe that a serious journalist would really do all of the work to figure out what was going on here and would be able to tie it back so effectively as you did to the UFO phenomena. So what I'm going to do is I've been authorized to show you some documents. Now, you can't take pictures of them. You can't take notes on them. You're able to see these documents. And what I propose is that you and I open up a channel of communication. You tell me what you know. I'll tell you what the U.S. government knows. This is literally every UFO investigator's dream scenario, to have this high-level classified information exchanged with you and validated in front of you. So Howe is skeptical, but you know, she takes the bait and she grabs this document that he's showing her that says at the top of it, it says like, prepared for the President of the United States, at the very top, regarding the cattle mutilation phenomena. She opens it up and she reads through it and reads through it and reads through it. And essentially it paints this twisted web, this wild picture, this wild journey that ends up with the idea that Homo sapiens are a genetically manipulated species that was created by alien beings in the distant past. She was briefed regarding alien-human hybrids and the true meaning behind the cattle mutilation phenomena. Now, I don't know exactly what it was that tipped Linda Moulton Howell off to this being fake. I can't tell you exactly.
What?
Because, and here's the thing, because she, as far as I know, and I've seen her all over, she's on Ancient Aliens all the time. She's really a mainstay of modern ufology. She, as far as I know, still believes certain aspects of this. Especially what I just said, I'm pretty sure she believes fully. Yet, she was able to, one way or the other, say, okay, something's not right here. And she was able to publicly name Richard Doty as the man that she met with. So then you have a Freedom of Information Act regarding Doty that's put in, and they find him popping up as an investigator on a UFO incident, basically. And so that's how everybody knows that this is actually real, that he's a real person, and he appears to be working with or embedding himself somehow into the UFO community for the express purpose of giving this disinformation.
Wow.
I know. It's insane. It's literally, it's like a conspiracy come true. And I love that. I love it. Now, unfortunately, it doesn't really help us too much to know that, because according to Doty, I mean, it helps us, but not in any real tangible way, because Doty, mm-hmm. by his own admission, again, he is this disinfo agent. He claims that he would give people mixed information. The information would be 20% factual and 80% false. And that by wrapping it all together, you could basically control the narrative. Now, we'll talk about him more throughout this episode and the next episode. But this is the man who walks into Paul Benowitz's home on October 26th. This guy whose entire job is to find out what people know, to stop them from knowing it, and to manipulate it and change the narrative into what the government wants you to think instead. And that's, it's really Benowitz's patriotism that is his downfall. Because he is so trusting of the government, which is, he's trusting of the government because he thinks the government is like listening to him. But the government's only listening to him because they know that he has footage and evidence that they have things beyond what they're disclosing. And like I said, near the top of this, that silent helicopter is the exact perfect thing. Like you said, that's the same one that they used to kill Bin Laden. They took out Bin Laden with the stealth helicopter that was in operation in the 1970s and yet was a legend for decades until we finally in the 2000s had the technology to do it. But they had the technology 30 years early and they just didn't tell anybody about it. And it's just, it's astounding. It's just wild. I love it.
Okay, so then Doty gets in and starts messing with Paul. And eventually, I'm assuming, Paul goes down a horrible rabbit hole.
Oh, we're
going to
get there. That's next.
It's the Moleman instead?
That's next week. We're going to get there. Don't worry.
Of course.
So okay. On October 26th, like I said, 2 days after he calls the base, after the NSA comes in, after the disinfo agents come in, Doty himself, along with a physicist by the name of Lou Miles, who is the chief scientist and director of the Kirtland Test and Evaluation Center, they visit Paul at his home. Miles was also associated with Project Blue Book back in the day. And the two were let into Paul's home laboratory and were shocked by what they found. A huge amount of equipment. Like I said, a lot of it, especially the audio, audio receiving, he builds it himself. He makes it himself. And this equipment that he makes is able to pick up these classified, frickin' coded transmissions. And he's just able to pick it up and go with that. Hundreds of feet of tape, feats, hundreds of feet of tape. There we go. Photographs, everything. It's all crammed into this one tiny room. And as Paul starts talking to them, he's explaining that what he's found is that the aliens are going to invade. They're going to take over. They may even already be among us. And more important than anything else is that Paul knows about the secret, hidden, underground base beneath the Archuleta Mesa, just north of Dulce, New Mexico. He knows about the base. He knows there's something there. And he just wants to know what they know about the base.
Okay, so before we jump too much further, we've got a few different strings going on.
We got a lot of strings.
We've got the strings of mutilations, which are occurring at the same time as Paul is recording and discovering and making observations, correct?
Yes. They're happening. Technically, okay. They start way before, but they do continue up till that point.
Right. Okay. So it sounds, unfortunately, like Paul did stumble upon hearing things that he wasn't supposed to be hearing.
Yes.
And instead of jumping to the logical conclusion that this is simply a coded military message of some sort, he goes kind of the route, I think probably because of the lights that he sees, down the path of his own personal bias, which is that it's extraterrestrial. Yes. Code. Okay.
Yes. But why does
he do
that?
And now he's basically put these gentlemen in the hot seat.
Yes.
To answer his questions.
Exactly.
Because he's basically, I've got you red-handed.
Yeah. I know that there's something going on underneath the Archuleta Mesa, which is just a couple of miles north, if even a couple of miles north, of Dulce, New Mexico. I know there's something going on down there. What's going on? What is it? Tell me. That's what's happening essentially here. I don't know that he's necessarily straight up interrogating them at this point, but narratively, this happens. This is his goal in one big way, is to tie everything together by use of, again, this underground base. But
he's talking to the disinformation.
He's talking to the disinformation agents. And the question then comes up with, what the heck is he talking about? Why would he think there's an underground base in Dulce? That at least, apparently, is most likely what Rick Doty and Lou Miles were talking about on their way back to Kirtland Air Force Base to debrief about this, because it kind of comes out of left field, unless you're Paul Benowitz, in which case it makes perfect sense. Because the reason why he knew that this was not just the military, and he knew that there were aliens in the first place, and that the aliens were among us, and that they were involved, they were planning a takeover, and they may already, you know, be taking over as we speak, is because of something that happened before, even before he started recording this, or not recording, but before Rick Doty even gets to the base, in, I think it's June of that year. So before, well, when is it? So April 29th. Oh, April 20th. Yeah. Okay. So before any of this happens, before the lights start showing up and he starts recording them, before Rick Doty gets to the base, before he calls the base and has all of his information, there is this cattle mutilation conference that happens on April 20th, 1979, at the Albuquerque.
Boy, how do you make the flyer for that?
it's a pretty not safe for work flyer, I hate to say.
Yeah.
There is this cattle mutilation conference, Albuquerque Public Library. Benowitz is like, hey, this sounds like a great way to spend my Friday, because he has already had an interest in this. He UFOs and the cattle mutilation are already linked in a lot of people's minds, especially Benowitz's. So he says, yeah, this sounds like a great way to spend a Friday. There's also a very interesting side note, which is that on this same day, April 20th, 1979, a rabbit tried to kill Jimmy Carter, apparently, and he was like in a boat, and the rabbit like started running towards and like swimming, and everyone was like, Jimmy Carter, a rabbit can't swim, and it wouldn't come swimming towards you. But then he produced photographic evidence of himself in a boat with a rabbit coming towards him, and everybody made fun of him. Poor Jimmy Carter, he gets a bad rap, I think.
Jimmy's the best.
I know it. Anyway, it was just a strange thing that popped up as I was Googling to figure out what day of the week that was.
That is very weird. I thought you were going to make like a Monty Python reference or something.
That's a lot of people did or do or whatever. Anyway, so he's at the conference, Benowitz is, and he meets none other than our fearless cattle cop, Gabe Valdez. Naturally. The two...
Okay, so our strings are tying together.
They're all coming together, Bob. That was the hardest part of this episode, is how the heck does everybody know each other? And where are these ideas coming from? It's just wild. Anyway, so they meet at the cattle conference. Paul gives Gabe his card. He says, hey, keep in touch. And the two would. They traded information about cattle mutilations and UFOs whenever possible. And one of the more interesting things that developed out of this relationship, one way or the other, was that Valdez shared his theory with Benowitz that the cattle mutilations were being conducted A, by human government agencies, which B, operated out of an underground base that had been built out of the by expanding existing mining tunnels in the Archuleta Mesa immediately north of the town of Dulce, New Mexico. Essentially, he claims to have found an entrance to this base, and he believed that the operations, at least the ones taking place in Dulce, as far as the cattle mutilations happened, were being flown up and out and then brought back there, and there they did the stuff, and then they would go and drop it back in the fields. Now, this idea caught hold in Benowitz's mind like a fever, and it wouldn't be long until Paul stumbled upon the next clue as to what was really going on out here. See, on May 5th of 1980, an event occurred which would shape the UFO community in large ways into what it has become today, or at least certain aspects of it. It was that evening when a 27-year-old woman named Myrna Hansen saw, in the company of her 8-year-old son, two absolutely massive, silent, triangular crafts hovering over a meadow. The mother and child saw a blue light, which focused on a cow, and then seemed to pull it upwards into the air. In the middle of this event, it stopped completely. Not that the cow stopped going up or the light stopped. In the middle of the event, it was over. The cow was gone, the lights were gone, the craft was gone. They were sitting in their car, and the engine was turned off. The two were on their way home after a long road trip. They had planned and were on track to arrive home at about 9 p.m., but they didn't pull into their driveway until 1 a.m., with no memory of what happened during the interceding 4 hours. Now, Hansen called the police of the nearest town that they were when this happened to him. She starts telling her story, and the cop who answers the phone then says, you know what, I've got someone you should talk to here. He then puts her in contact with Gabe Valdez, by virtue of his being involved with cattle mutilations and UFOs and all that sort of crap. Valdez, yep, in turn, puts Myrna in contact with Benowitz, who offered her and her son the opportunity to come stay with him, firstly, out of concern for their safety, because they were freaked out and he was freaked out, and secondly, so that Benowitz could chat with her and get to the bottom of what was going on here. At this point, Paul was a card-carrying member of APRO, the Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, which was the premier UFO group in the country at that time, pretty much. Now, as a physicist, Benowitz was a useful member who would often ride along with UFO investigators to question witnesses regarding scientific things and try to figure out all of that. So he says, okay, I've done that before. I'll just do it again. I'll do it with these people. And she's freaked out. She could come stay with me and my wife. We've got more than enough space. It's all going to be fine. So she shows up just 2 days after the event. So on the 7th, and she kind of moves in and lives with the Benowitzes for a little bit of time. Now, try as he might, Benowitz was not able to get any information out of her beyond we saw the light, we saw the craft, we saw the cow, and then suddenly it was 4 hours later, and then we got home. She just wasn't able to get past it. So he goes to APRO director James Lorenzen, who then advises Benowitz to bring a professional into the process. He suggests a man named Leo Sprinkle, who is a psychologist and a tenured professor at the University of Wisconsin, who had been working with APRO for a decade. He arrives at the Benowitz home on the 11th of May and suggests that they perform a hypnotic regression in order to try to uncover any memories that might be hiding behind a veil of trauma. Now, before we see what happens, it's important to realize that she had been in the Benowitz home for 4 days. She had basically been steadily fed a diet of fear. And
Sam, are you suggesting?
What? What am I suggesting?
That suggestion was made.
I may be suggesting that suggestion was made. Maybe.
Okay.
Possibly. But yeah, she's like, he's like talking to her about what the aliens are and what they're doing and all of this. Because again, at this point, this is May of 1980. So he is done. He has seen the lights. He's recording the lights. He knows something's happening over at the base. So he is already starting to get kind of freaked out as well. Now, when Sprinkle arrives, they decide that the best way of doing this, and by they I mean everyone other than Sprinkle, decides that the best way of doing this is to put Myrna, Paul, and Sprinkle in Paul's car, to wrap the car with tinfoil, and conduct the regression. So that way the aliens that are just over the mountain are not going to be able to get into her head or anything like that. And Sprinkle was a little bit put off by this, to say the least. He was like, I guess if it's going to make you feel better, we can do that. So they prep the car. They slide inside. Myrna enters hypnosis with almost no resistance. And once she does, she is finally able to break through the psychic barrier which had prevented her from knowing what happened after seeing the craft. This is her exact words. Quote, I'm driving. My son's right there in my ear talking to me. I'm half tuning him out. The light is so bright. I feel like it's coming in on me. I stop the car and we get out. This isn't real. It can't be happening. What is it? There's another one. The bright is confusing. I want to leave, but I want to see what it is. My son wants to leave, but I've got to know what's going on. So much commotion. They're landing. Oh, God. Cattle are screaming. But I've got to know what it is. This light is so bright. It's orange. I want to see them. I want to go to them. I'm out of the car, screaming of the cattle. It's horrible. It's horrible. Incredible pain. I still want to go to them, but they're mad. Unquote. Now, she tells this story. This story is only broken at one point in the narrative. And the only point in the narrative when it breaks is when Myrna asks, kind of out loud, right? Because she's regressed. So this must just be a question. I don't know that she, or a thought. I don't know if she's actually addressing it to Paul and to Sprinkle. She may be addressing it to whatever's on the ship, but she says out loud, where is Roswell, New Mexico? And they ignore it. They have no reason to think about Roswell, New Mexico. The reason they have no reason to think about Roswell, New Mexico is that at this point in 1980, Roswell was pretty much forgotten. It was obviously a big thing when it happened, but over the intervening 33 years, it kind of just fell into obscurity. And I don't even know that they were aware of what happened at Roswell. The general public wouldn't be aware until that that same year, a little bit later, when a man named Bill Moore, William Moore, who we'll talk about more in connection to all of this, he writes a book, the very first book ever written about Roswell, called The Roswell Incident. And that is where this idea of Roswell being like the founding event of ufology in America, that's where it comes from. Everybody else had forgotten about it by that point, for the most part, except for the super.
But her question predates that revival of Roswell in the general
public. And so they don't even really think about it too much. So that's important to keep in mind. So Myrna tells them this narrative. Essentially, what happens is that the abduction of the cow, which they saw, was followed by their own abduction. They had gotten out of the car, kind of against their own wills. And you get that from what she was saying. She's like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be doing this, but I have to go see that light. It's so bright. What's going on? So they're being guided, essentially, out of the car. Once they're out of the car, they're lifted up into the craft, and there they come in contact with grays. The grays undress them, they examine them. They both, she and her son, see the cow that had been abducted. They see it mutilated in the manner consistent with the mutilations on the ground. Myrna talks about a tall, jaundiced man in what looks like priestly attire who told her that her abduction was a mistake. And then the craft lands in the desert somewhere. The two are led to an elevator. They descend underground into a mountain. The mountain is full of aliens and human beings working literally side by side together, studying, doing experiments. Her son is taken from her. She tries to run after him. She gets disoriented, and she finds herself in a room full of clear, illuminated tanks. The tanks are full of bubbling liquid in which are suspended various human body parts. She collapses, regains consciousness, and sees that her alien captors are doing some sort of surgery on her, inserting devices into her. Then she and her son are both taken to a room where they are bombarded with flashes of light and then returned to the car. As you can imagine, this was concerning to everyone involved. For Sprinkle, it was extremely concerning because details of this case somehow lined up with another case that had occurred 7 years previous when a woman in Houston, Texas, in the year 1973, saw a bright light in the sky following her and her family as they returned home from a bingo night. The light descended upon them, and they saw a huge disc with windows floating over the home. Then it shot off upwards into the night. But during later hypnotic regressions, Sprinkle was able to get the woman. Her name was Judy Doherty. She remembered that that's actually not exactly how it happened. As she was driving home, she turned off the car, got out of the car, and she, as well as a small animal of some kind, or an animal of some kind, was lifted into the sky by a sort of tractor beam. She claimed to experience a bilocation phenomena, where she was both standing on the ground by her car, as well as standing within the disc at the same time. She realizes that the animal is a young calf. It is mutilated, consistent with the mutilations that had been seen, would be seen years later, and had already been seen at that point. The mutilation phenomena began near the end of the 60s, so she would have already had some previous knowledge of it. But she sees this mutilation. She remembers seeing her young daughter being examined by gray aliens who had performed the cattle mutilation. But out of all of these details of similarity, there was one that was beyond coincidence, because both Judy Doherty and Myrna Hansen remember that while witnessing the cattle mutilations, they had received a message from the aliens that was, quote, "This has to be done," unquote. They both independently report this to Sprinkle in the midst of hypnosis. So he's shook. Myrna's obviously shook. But I think maybe the shookest of all is Benowitz. Because to Benowitz, it is perfectly clear through his interactions with Valdez, he knows where she was taken. And where she was taken was Archuleta Mesa in Dulce, New Mexico. His further involvement and the disinformation and everything that comes after, because there is things that come after when it comes to Dulce and Paul Benowitz, that is going to be what we talk about next episode. But before we do, I mentioned earlier, I said Gabe Valdez probably came the closest, if not hit it right on the head, as to understanding what was going on here with the cattle mutilation, at least in my opinion. So let's see what he says, and then we'll wrap it up. Sound good?
Anything
you want to say about that hypnotic regression?
Well, I mean, I feel like I've discussed hypnosis before, and where, especially with the fact that she's been with Benowitz for so long, that the possibility of suggestion, and also, of course, the fact that she's been under distress for quite a while, I would probably throw all of it out the window, to be completely honest.
Okay, all right.
Just because there is so much that can be tampered with. That end, generally speaking, again, like, people want to satisfy others. Mm-hmm. And subconsciously, that might be following along with the story. Also, I think it's pretty... I'm sure Benowitz has probably slipped the notion that there is a base somewhere nearby to her as they stayed with him. So I can't really take this information as usable or credible. In this kind of mindset. Also, it's too much of like a dead ringer win for Benowitz.
Yeah.
Like,
it's too much exactly what he wants to have to hear. Or theoretically,
it's too perfect.
Is already considering
and
thinking of.
So it's already exactly what he wants to hear, which is usually not a good thing when you're actually looking for, like, truthfulness in an investigation. Everything for him so far is kind of playing out the way he wants it to, even though he's being fed incorrect information. I think he feels like he's on this path of discovering, about to crack the whole thing, and he's doing so well. But I think also it's probably, he's probably got a little bit of the blinders on and not realizing that he himself is contaminating his own experiments.
Yeah, I think that's more than fair.
And it doesn't make a lot of sense if they weren't supposed to be taken to thus get taken somewhere else and then performed experiments
It's kind of the
and then dropped off back home,
yeah,
you know?
It's kind of the idea of,
if they weren't supposed to be taken, then just put them right back and mind wipe them like you already did.
It's kind of the idea of like, well, you're here now.
We have them here anyway.
Now. Sorry. Yeah. Wrong place, wrong time. Here we go. But no, I think that's all totally fair, and it's...
Well, I mean, like, if you're fishing and you've got, like, in your net fishing or something, and you're looking for a particular catch, generally speaking, you're throwing back the rest.
Maybe. Unless you're starving, in which case you keep them all and you eat them.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think.
But it sounds like they're not starving. It sounds like they're getting plenty of candidates for experimentation.
Yeah, probably. That is the main concern. Well, what you bring up is the main concern with hypnosis to begin with. And it's why many people don't necessarily see it as any sort of valid. And that's the thing. That's what's most disappointing, is that most of the really good stories, the really amazing stuff, we find it out under hypnosis. And it can go both ways. You know, the one argument on the believing side as well, either because of certain aspects of you know, alien technology in order to wipe memories, or simply the body's trauma response It makes
right. I mean, the human psyche is incredibly complex, and we are barely understanding
right.
it.
It makes
to any
it
degree.
Makes sense then that these would be even naturally hidden, even if there wasn't the strange bright lights, and inaccessible in order to help shield the survivors. And then, of course, on the other side, it's like, well, or, you know, they're just projecting their subconscious ideas of what happened. You know, when something like
yeah,
this
I mean,
happens,
it's not like humans have been telling stories for right. tens of thousands of years or anything.
It's not like we have certain archetypes that pop up in our dreams and in our stories and in our language and whatever. And when something like this happens to you, if it takes you, let's see. So it happened the 5th, gets there the 7th. The hypnosis takes place on the 11th. So 6 days later, I guarantee you that for 6 days, all she did was sit and think about what happened and, you know, what could have happened and why can't she remember what might have happened.
Right. And if anyone has sat and thought about anything that seems stressful to them for more than an hour, it only worsens.
Exactly.
Things.
And it gets embedded that, oh, this is what happened. So again, I freaking love it. I think it's amazing. It's terrifying, and it gets a lot scarier on both sides as we go forward. But I just don't know how to feel.
I kind of want a miniseries about it.
Yeah, yeah, I dig it. Anyway, so let's talk about Valdez real quick, and then we'll wrap up. Okay.
Yeah, so back to Valdez, which up until this point, he's been investigating mutilations. Uh-huh. He's kind of known as that mutilation / UFO guy at the police station.
Yep.
He has been working with Paul.
Yep.
Benowitz, and he believes that there is a base of some
yep.
sort in the Mesa.
Yep.
Correct? Is that pretty much wrapping up what Valdez has done
That's
so far?
That's what he's got. That's what he's got so far. And then he takes all of this and he puts it together to make a remarkably good theory. And Valdez he's just a great guy. I've watched interviews with him. He seems like a really great guy. He's really genuine. He's not whacked out, cracked out. You know, he's not way out there or anything. And that's what I appreciate about him and why we're kind of bidding him a fond farewell, because he doesn't really show back up in our story. But it's worth noting that his idea, what he uncovered and how he understands this to be, is that in December of 1967, remember, cattle mutilations, they begin right around 1967. In December of that year, the United States Atomic Energy Commission exploded a nuclear device underground in order to shake some natural gas and oil resources loose. Basically, it's like nuclear fracking is what they did.
That doesn't sound dangerous
no,
at all.
No, it doesn't. And basically, it was part of this larger project. So the project itself is called Project Gas Buggy. It's part of a larger project that I can't remember the name of, which the whole point was, hey, we've got these nukes. What are some nice...
Why not figure
yeah,
out
what
how
are
to
some
use
nice
them, yeah.
things we can do with them, maybe? What's some peaceful things? And then they were like, well, we can't use any of this oil. It's all radioactive. What the heck? So, which, of course, looking back, we're like idiots, but...
Duh. Yeah.
Who knows? Who knows what it was like back then? So essentially, according to Valdez, this takes place not far necessarily from Dulce and New Mexico and really this western area that the locus of these mutilations are happening in. So he figures out that essentially what they're doing is the U.S. government is taking these cows and it is testing them to see what their levels of radiation were like. Now, it's public record that people with Geiger counters would go all over these areas testing the radiation fairly frequently. There was even an agent whose entire job was basically just to go out, go all over the place and buy locally raised and slaughtered beef undercover in order to test it for radiation. So according to Valdez, the cattle mutilation then takes it one step further, which is to say that these other areas of the cattle, which are not really able to be legally bought without raising huge amounts of suspicion, are stolen in the night from them. So you have...
Right, and that makes sense if... Because, I mean, bringing cattle to market, that's one specific time of the year versus being able to do this exactly. year-round.
So you have this happening, and then also, in addition to the gas buggy tests and the trying to figure out the radiation, you also have Kirtland Air Force Base and relatively close, not super close, but relatively close speaking, you have Groom Lake, Area 51. Basically, you just have experimental aircraft that are being tested. These two things are confluenced into one. Valdez, especially in that one event we talked about near the top of the show with the Apache Chief's cow, and they kind of corner the UFO in the field and it disappears. Basically, it keeps disappearing and reappearing until Valdez says, hey, everybody, turn off your radios. Let's stop talking about this together. And just when it reappears, just go to it. As soon as they do that, it stops this kind of like hide and seek chase game. And it just goes away. And so Valdez believes that whoever is operating this is listening to the police scanner as they're doing it, and kind of doing it to test their capabilities and to say, okay, what can we get these people to believe? What can we get them to think? Now, going miles in a second, well, possibly there are multiple crafts, or you do have what, Jason, is one of your standard favorite things to say, which is if you're looking at a light at night in the sky, you really have absolutely no way other than what you think it should be to figure out how big it should be, how far it is from you. You don't have any points of reference. So that could be happening as well. Or finally, it could be that they really do have some incredibly fast thing that is quick, but not necessarily quick enough to traverse miles in the course of 3 seconds quick. So,
yeah, I would probably still be in the camp as far as that one's concerned to some sort of atmospheric phenomenon. Like I was saying before, when you try to chase the rainbow, you can never catch it.
Yeah.
And it might be something really weird reflecting or bouncing.
There you go. So in Valdez's mind, these two things, they come together, and it may be that the military who's doing the testing is aware of what's going on with the cattle mutilation, that they are encouraging this connection in order to invalidate, again, the people who are getting close to the truth, basically making it their own little disinformation campaign. Or it could just be a coincidence that, you know, the same area was being affected by both of these things. But that's his idea. And honestly, I think it's probably spot on. That definitely right. doesn't say.
Yeah, it could.
I'll go ahead.
It could also, I mean, it could be not necessarily the two separate events just being tied by location as well. But it could very well be, like you were saying earlier, we've got these experimental crafts. Let's use them for something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
There's this low risk operation going on to test cattle for radiation levels. Why not use them mm-hmm. there?
Yeah. And so in regards to the original question that I said we'd put off, which is when are these things being marked? Who's marking them? I think it's totally possible that it is agents on the ground, because theoretically it can be a separate phenomena. You know, the agents on the ground, because Valdez finds the gas mask, he finds the syringes, it's not unlikely that they are doing this mutilation, or at least parts of it, they're on the ground, taking it away, coming back, whatever. So that's what I would say, is probably people on the ground who are just really sneaky and not being seen. But okay, Jason, what...
We'll get to knowing more next time.
Next
huh?
time we're going to talk about the tragic demise of Paul Benowitz. We're going to talk about the base itself that is theoretically underneath the ground, and the war that occurred, the firefight between the humans and extraterrestrials that occurred there as well. So we've got a whole lot going on. Again, next week, it might be quite a long episode, just because I want us to cover a lot of things this summer. It's summertime. It's fun time. Let's talk about crazy crap. and enjoy the sun while everything burns around us. So, yeah, that's what I got.
Couldn't put it better myself.
You know where to find us. That's all I'm going to say. If you don't, then I don't blame you. And I don't want it. I don't know what I don't want, but I don't want it. So that's all I have to say about that. Who did it last week? And by last week, I mean 6 weeks ago.
I want to say it was you.
Go ahead.
Remember, whether you're marking a future experimentation or if you're picking up some quick beef to go, you are
not alone.